Chapter 37. Socialists burst through the gates and stormed up through the ministerial benches, and a man in a red cravat reached up and snatched the documents that lay on the president's desk and flung them abroad. The next moment he and his allies were struggling and fighting with the half dozen uniformed servants who were there to protect the new gates. Meantime, a detail of socialists had swarmed up the side steps and overflowed the president and the vice, and were crowding and shouldering and shoving them out of the place. They crowded them out, and down the steps, and across the house, past the Polish benches, and all about them swarmed hostile Poles and Czechs, who resisted them. One could see fists go up and come down, with other signs and shows of a heady fight. Then the president and the vice disappeared through the door of entrance, and the victorious socialists turned and marched back, mounted the tribune, flung the president's bill and his remaining papers abroad, and then stood there in a compact little crowd, 11 strong, and held the place as if it were a fortress. Their friends on the floor were in a frenzy of triumph and manifested it in their deafening way. The whole house was on its feet, amazed and wondering. It was an astonishing situation, and imposingly dramatic. Nobody had looked for this. The unexpected had happened. What next? But there can be no next. The play is over. The grand climax is reached. The possibilities are exhausted. Bring down the curtain. Not yet. That distant door opens again. And now we see what history will be talking of 5 centuries hence. A uniformed and helmeted battalion of bronzed and stalwart men marching in double file down the floor of the house, a free parliament profaned by an invasion of brute force. It was an odious spectacle, odious and awful. For one moment it was an unbelievable thing, a thing beyond all credibility. It must be a delusion, a dream, a nightmare. But no, it was real, pitifully real, shamefully real, hideously real. These 60 policemen had been soldiers, and they went at their work with the cold unsentimentality of their trade. They ascended the steps of the tribune, laid their hands upon the inviolable persons of the representatives of a nation, and dragged and tugged, and hauled them down the steps, and out at the door, then ranged themselves in stately military array in front of the ministerial estrade, and so stood. It was a tremendous episode. The memory of it will outlast all the thrones that exist today. In the whole history of free parliaments, the like of it had been seen but 3 times before. It takes its imposing place among the world's unforgettable things. I'd think that in my lifetime I have not twice seen abiding history made before my eyes, but I know that I have seen it once. Some of the results of this wild freak followed instantly. The Badeni government came down with a crash. There was a popular outbreak or two in Vienna. There were 3 or 4 days of furious rioting in Prague, followed by the establishing there of martial law. The Jews and Germans were harried and plundered, and their houses destroyed. In other Bohemian towns there was rioting, in some cases the Germans being the rioters, in others the Czechs, and in all cases the Jew had to roast, no matter which side he was on. We are well along in December now. 3. The next new minister president has not been able to patch up a peace among the warring factions of the parliament, therefore there is no use in calling it together again for the present. Public opinion believes that parliamentary government and the constitution are actually threatened with extinction, and that the permanency of the monarchy itself is a not absolutely certain thing. Yes, the Lex Falkenhayn was a great invention, and did what was claimed for it. It got the government out of the frying pan. 1. That is, revolution. 2. In that gracious bygone time, when a mild and good-tempered spirit was the atmosphere of our house, when the manner of our speakers was studiously formal and academic, and the storms and explosions of today were wholly unknown, apostrophe etc. Translation of the opening remark of a leading article in this morning's Nieuwe Vrije Pers, apostrophe December 11. 3. It is the 9th. M. T. P. private history of the jumping frog story. 5 or 6 years ago, a lady from Finland asked me to tell her a story in our Negro dialect so that she could get an idea of what that variety of speech was like. I told her one of Hopkins and Smith's Negro stories and gave her a copy of Harper's Monthly containing it. She translated it for a Swedish newspaper, but by an oversight, named me as the author of it instead of Smith. I was very sorry for that, because I got a good lashing in the Swedish press, which would have fallen to his share, but for that mistake. For it was shown that Boccaccio had told that very story, in his curt and meager fashion, 500 years before Smith took hold of it, and made a good and tellable thing out of it. I have always been sorry for Smith. But my own turn has come now. A few weeks ago, Professor Van Dyke, of Princeton, asked this question. Do you know how old your jumping frog story is? And I answered. Yes, 45 years. The thing happened in Calaveras County, in the spring of 1849. No, it happened earlier, a couple of thousand years earlier. It is a Greek story. I was astonished and hurt. I said, I am willing to be a literary thief, if it has been so ordained. I am even willing to be caught robbing the ancient dead alongside of Hopkins and Smith, for he is my friend and a good fellow, and I think would be as honest as anyone, if he could do it without occasioning remark. But I am not willing to antedate his crimes by 1500 years. I must ask you to knock off part of that. But the professor was not chaffing. He was in earnest, and could not abate a century. He offered to get the book, and send it to me, and the Cambridge textbook containing the English translation also. I thought I would like the translation best, because Greek makes me tired. January 30th he sent me the English version, and I will presently insert it in this article. It is my jumping frog tale in every essential. It is not strung out as I have strung it out, but it is all there. To me this is very curious and interesting. Curious for several reasons. For instance, I heard the story told by a man who was not telling it to his hearers as a thing new to them, but as a thing which they had witnessed and would remember. He was a dull person, and ignorant. He had no gift as a storyteller, and no invention. In his mouth this episode was merely history and statistics. And the gravest sort of history too. He was entirely serious, for he was dealing with what to him were austere facts, and they interested him, solely because they were facts. He was drawing on his memory, not his mind. He saw no humor in his tale, neither did his listeners. Neither he nor they ever smiled or laughed. In my time I have not attended a more solemn conference. To him and to his fellow gold miners there were just two things in the story that were worth considering. One was the smartness of its hero, Jim Smiley, in taking the stranger in with a loaded frog. And the other was Smiley's deep knowledge of a frog's nature, for he knew, as the narrator asserted and the listeners conceded, that a frog likes shot, and is already ready to eat it. Those men discussed those two points, and those only. They were hearty in their admiration of them, and none of the party was aware that a first-rate story had been told in a first-rate way, and that it brimful of a quality whose presence they never suspected, humor. Now then, the interesting question is, did the frog episode happen in Angel's Camp in the spring of 49, as told in my hearing, that day in the fall of 1865? I am perfectly sure that it did. I am also sure that its duplicate happened in Boeotia a couple of thousand years ago. I think it must be a case of history actually repeating itself, and not a case of a good story floating down the ages and surviving, because too good to be allowed to perish. I would now like to have the reader examine the Greek story, and the story told by the dull and solemn Californian, and observe how exactly alike they are in essentials. Translation. The Athenian and the Frog. 1. An Athenian once fell in with a Boeotian who was sitting by the roadside looking at a frog. Seeing the other approach, the Boeotian said it was a remarkable frog, and asked if he would agree to start a contest of frogs, on condition that he whose frog jumped farthest should receive a large sum of money. The Athenian replied that he would, if the other would fetch him a frog, for the lake was near. To this he agreed, and when he was gone the Athenian took the frog, and, opening its mouth, poured some stones into its stomach, so that it did not indeed seem larger than before, but could not jump. The Boeotian soon returned with the other frog, and the contest began. The second frog first was pinched, and jumped moderately. Then they pinched the Boeotian frog, and he gathered himself for a leap, and used the utmost effort, but he could not move his body the least. So the Athenian departed with the money. When he was gone the Boeotian, wondering what was the matter with the frog, lifted him up and examined him. And being turned upside down, he opened his mouth and vomited out the stones. And here is the way it happened in California. From the celebrated jumping frog of Calaveras County, well, Fisher Smiley had rat terriers and chicken cocks, and tom cats, and all of them kind of things, till you couldn't rest, and you couldn't fetch nothing for him to bet on, but he'd match you. He catched a frog one day, and took him home, and said he calculated to educate him, and so he never done nothing for 3 months, but sat in his backyard, and learned that frog to jump. And you bet you, he did learn him to. He'd give him a little punch behind, and the next minute you'd see that frog whirling in the air like a donut, see him turn one somerset, or maybe a couple, if he got a good start, and come down flat-footed and all right, like a cat. He got him up so in the matter of catching flies, and kept him in practice so constant, that he'd nail a fly every time as far as he could see him. Smiley said all a frog wanted was education, and he could do most anything, and I believe him. Why, I've seen him set Dan Webster down here on this floor. Dan Webster was the name of the frog, and sing out, "Flies, Dan, flies!" Apostrophe apostrophe and quick air new could wink he'd spring straight up, and snake a fly off the counter there, and flop down on the floor agin as solid as a gob of mud, and fall to scratching the side of his head with his hind foot as indifferent as if he hadn't no idea he'd been doing any more than any frog might do. You never see a frog so modest and straightforward as he was, for all he was so gifted. And when it come to fair and square jumping on a dead level, he could get over more ground at one straddle than any animal of his breed you ever see. Jumping on a dead level was his strong suit, you understand. And when it came to that, Smiley would ante up money on him, as long as he had a red. Smiley was monstrous proud of his frog, and well he might be, for fellers that had traveled and been everywheres all said he laid over any frog that ever they see. Well, Smiley kept the beast in a little lattice box, and he used to fetch him downtown sometimes and lay for a bet. One day a feller, a stranger in the camp, he was come across him with his box, and says, "What might it be that you've got in the box?" Apostrophe apostrophe, and Smiley says, sorter indifferent like, "It might be a parrot, or it might be a canary, maybe, but it's ain't, it's only just a frog." Apostrophe apostrophe, and the feller took it, and looked at it careful, and turned it round this way and that, and says, "H apostrophe M, so 'tis." "Well, what's he good for?" Apostrophe, "Well, apostrophe," Smiley says, "easy and careless. He's good enough for one thing, I should judge he can outjump any frog in Calaveras County." Apostrophe apostrophe, the feller took the box again, and took another long, particular look, and give it back to Smiley, and says, very deliberate, "Well, apostrophe," he says, "I don't see no pints about that frog that's any better than any other frog." Apostrophe apostrophe, "Maybe you don't," apostrophe Smiley says. "Maybe you understand frogs and maybe you don't understand them. Maybe you've had experience, and maybe you ain't only a amateur, as it were. Anyways, I've got my opinion, and I'll risk $40 that he can outjump any frog in Calaveras County." ..., and the feller studies a minute, and then says, kinder sad like, well, I'm only a stranger here, and I ain't got no frog, but if I had a frog I'd bet you. ..., and then smiley says, that's all right, if you'll hold my box a minute, I'll go and get you a frog. ..., and so the feller took the box, and put up his $40 along with Smiley's and sat down to wait. So he sat there a good, while thinking and thinking to himself, and then he got the frog out, and prized his mouth open, and took a teaspoon, and filled him full of quail shot, filled him pretty near up to his chin, and set him on the floor. Smiley he went to the swamp, and slopped around in the mud for a long time, and finally he catched a frog, and fetched him in, and give him to this feller, and says, now, if you're ready, set him alongside of Dan, with his four paws just even with Dan's, and I'll give the word. ..., then he says, 1, 2, 3, git. ..., and him, and the feller touched up the frogs from behind, and the new frog hopped off lively, but Dan'll give a heave, and hissed up his shoulders so like a Frenchman, but it weren't no use, he couldn't budge, he was planted as solid as a church, and he couldn't no more stir than if he was anchored out. Smiley was a good deal surprised, and he was disgusted too, but he didn't have no idea what the matter was, of course. The feller took the money and started away, and when he was going out at the door he sorter jerked his thumb over his shoulder so at Dan, and says again, very deliberate. Well, ..., he says, I don't see no pints about that frog that's any better than any other frog. ..., Smiley he stood scratching his head and looking down at Dan a long time, and at last he says, I do wonder what in the nation that frog throw it off for. I wonder if there ain't something the matter with him, he pears to look mighty baggy, somehow. ..., and he catched Dan by the nape of the neck, and hefted him, and says, why, blame my cats, if he don't weigh 5 pound. ..., and turned him upside down, and he belched out a double handful of shot. And then he see how it was, and he was the maddest man. He set the frog down, and took out after that feeler, but he never catched him. The resemblances are deliciously exact. There you have the Wily Beaton, and the Wily Jim Smiley waiting 2,000 years apart and waiting, each equipped with his frog and laying for the stranger. A contest is proposed for money. The Athenian would take a chance if the other would fetch him a frog. The Yankee says, I'm only a stranger here, and I ain't got a frog. But if I had a frog I'd bet you. ..., the Wily Boeotian and the Wily Californian, with that vast gulf of 2,000 years between, retire eagerly and go frogging in the marsh. The Athenian and the Yankee remain behind and work a best advantage, the one with pebbles, the other with shot. Presently the contest began. In the one case they pinched the Boeotian frog. In the other, him and the feller touched up the frogs from behind. ..., the Boeotian frog gathered himself for a leap, you can just see him. ..., but could not move his body in the least. The Californian frog gave a heave, but it weren't no use, he couldn't budge. ..., in both the ancient and the modern cases the strangers departed with the money. The Boeotian and the Californian wonder what is the matter with their frogs. They lift them and examine. They turn them upside down and out spills the informing ballast. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.